This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, April 3rd, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, newly released documents show the coordinated efforts of local and federal law enforcement agents to spy on and evict Occupy protesters. Palestinian prisoners go on hunger strike and clashes continue in the West Bank after questions are raised about the death of an ailing Palestinian prisoner in Israeli custody. And we'll go to northern Iraq, where mobile clinics are bringing much-needed medical services to local residents in disputed territories. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. More than 50 people died in western Afghanistan today when militants attacked a government compound where Taliban leaders were facing a trial. 9 suicide attackers detonated and killed at least 35 civilians and 9 Afghan troops. Another 90 people were hurt, most of them civilians. The Taliban has claimed responsibility and says the accused fighters were freed in the attack. In Tunisia, dozens of refugees who fled the Libyan war are on hunger strike, protesting in front of the UN offices in the capital. Several are already facing serious health effects. Roberto Nieto reports from Tunisia.
The 41 hunger strikers are residents of the UN High Commission for Refugees-run Shousha camp, located on the Tunisian border with Libya. Several of them have now been hospitalized. They're protesting the UN refusal to resettle them to a safe third country, where their human rights will be protected. They also want to draw attention to the poor living conditions in the camp that opened in 2011 as a result of the war in Libya. Rula Magakela is one of the protesters.
The conditions are not suitable. We are in the desert. The Shousha camp is controlled by Tunisia and the United Nations. What the United Nations tell the Tunisian authorities to do is what they are doing.
Shousha once housed thousands of refugees. While the majority have been granted asylum and relocated, 250 people remain at the camp and continue to live in limbo under dire conditions, with some of the refugees claiming they don't have enough food and water. The camp is set to close at the end of June, and the refugees fear that they will be left to fend for themselves in Tunisia with no international support, and where refugees fear the racism that exists towards dark-skinned people. Roberto Nieto, FSRN in Tunisia.
Tensions are rising in the small town of Willits, California, as the state continues to push the construction of a highway. Opponents say the project is costly and will decimate wetlands. Authorities used rubber bullets yesterday to extract tree sitters protesting the project. Christina Onnestad has more.
A video posted on YouTube shows California Highway Patrol officers in a bucket truck about 30 feet in the air shooting rubber bullets at a tree sitter just feet away. All 4 tree sitters and a few protesters were arrested. California Senator Noreen Evans said the officers used excessive force. CHP claims that one tree sitter threw human waste at them. Protesters climbed the tree several days ago, with one sitting there for more than 2 months to stop construction of an estimated $250 million highway bypass project around the town of Willits. Opponents say it will destroy wetlands and habitat for sensitive species like salmon. To drain the wetlands, the California Department of Transportation, the lead agency of the project, plans to insert tens of thousands of poles into the land to suck the water out. The agency says they've considered alternatives, but the bypass is the best trucking route around Willits. A lawsuit challenging the project is pending in court. Christina Onnestad, California, FSRN.
After rumors in Senegal that lawmakers were considering legislation that would decriminalize homosexuality, a leader of the country's ruling party denied the claim. Anti-gay activists, as well as religious and cultural groups, are vowing to block any move by parliament to legalize gay marriage. FSRN's Alpha Jallo reports from Dakar.
Anti-gay rights protesters took to the streets of Dakar Tuesday after word that human rights groups recently held a secret meeting with senior officials of Senegal's National Health Ministry. According to Amnesty International's Sidi Gassama, they joined Senegalese gay rights groups like RADO and called for parliament to decriminalize homosexuality and to legalize gay marriage. Gassama said that It is the duty of rights organization to defend the rights of citizens. The religious hardline NGO Jamra responded by kicking off a countrywide tour to highlight to religious leaders what they call the dangers of legalizing homosexuality. In Senegal, homosexual acts are illegal and punishable by up to 5 years in jail and a $2,000 fine. Alpha Diallo, Free Speech Radio News, Dakar, Senegal.
If all goes according to plan, gay couples in Uruguay should be able to legally marry by this summer. Yesterday, the country's Senate overwhelmingly passed a bill that would update more than 20 laws to provide marriage equality. The measure includes equal rules for in vitro fertilization and adoption, and also allows parents to decide whose surname comes first on a child's birth certificate. The president is expected to sign the law. And women in France now have access to free pregnancy terminations, and girls between the ages of 15 and 18 can get free and anonymous birth control. The services that were approved last year as part of the country's 2013 Social Security budget went into effect this week. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Doreen Marina in Los Angeles. The U.S. government routinely kept tabs on Occupy encampments through monitoring and coordinating surveillance, according to new government documents obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. Much of the online surveillance of activist groups was carried out through the Department of Homeland Security's fusion centers, which were set up after September 11, 2001, to analyze terrorist threats. The revelations come as members of Congress debate reforms to the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which currently allows the government to access private email content, online conversations, and cell phone location data without a warrant. In Washington, FSRN's Alice Olstein has the story.
More than 500 pages of newly released documents from the FBI, Homeland Security, and local police departments show that the government devoted significant resources to tracking peaceful Occupy protests in at least 20 major cities. Attorney Heather Benno with the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, the organization that obtained the documents, said the memos themselves show that the activists, who largely engaged in lawful First Amendment activity, presented no real danger.
Government agencies knew, for the most part, that these were protests about political issues. They weren't provocateurs, people who were intending to do any harm aside from make demands, political demands, in a grassroots way. And in order to justify using all of the resources that the federal government had at its disposal to intervene and to collect information on this protest movement, it characterized the protest movement itself as a threat.
The heavily redacted documents include intelligence briefings from the Department of Homeland Security's Threat Management Division. Sections include domestic terrorist acts and activity, significant criminal activity, and peaceful activist demonstrations. And Benno says the goal of the Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, was not just information gathering.
There was one particular document from Detroit where, for example, there's communication between a law enforcement agent and one of the DHS representatives about having been tasked with coming up with an exit strategy for Occupy. So there were definitely, we have proof in these records to show that there were conversations going on between federal and local law enforcement about getting Occupy encampments broken up.
Some of the government surveillance was carried out in person by uniformed and undercover police, but much of it took place online. Because the Electronic Communications Privacy Act hasn't been updated since it was passed in 1986, the government can read the content of most private emails, online chats, and any documents stored in the cloud without getting a warrant. It can also get the geolocation data from the cell phones of private citizens to track their movements. Lawmakers in the House and Senate have introduced legislation to change this, requiring government agencies to prove probable cause of a crime to a judge and get a warrant before they can access this online data. But the bills face opposition from the government agencies engaged in surveillance, including those monitoring the Occupy movement. At a panel discussion at Google's DC headquarters on Wednesday, former Deputy Assistant Attorney General Jason Weinstein argued that the government needs these spying powers to catch criminals.
In our view, in the department's view, and I think this has been the department's view for a long time, and I think will continue to be, failing to distinguish between the different types of information and requiring a warrant for everything without distinction would impair the government's ability to bring many different types of cases successfully, from identity theft and cyber cases and white-collar cases to murder cases and cases that affect people's physical safety.
Weinstein said there should be some method for the government to get online and mobile information that's easier than a warrant, but that agencies should notify the user that their information is being taken and give them the opportunity to challenge the order. Open Internet advocates are mobilizing next week around updating the Electronic Communications Privacy Act and other laws they say are outdated and stifle free expression online. The actions are planned to coincide with the trial that had been scheduled for activist Aaron Schwartz, who was charged with violating another decades-old internet law, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Facing the possibility of a long jail sentence for downloading publicly funded academic articles off the database JSTOR, Schwartz committed suicide in January. His friends and supporters will be calling on Congress members next week to change what they call vague and outdated statutes and, quote, protect innovators and internet users. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Dozens of Palestinians continued protests in the West Bank today following the death yesterday of prisoner Maisara Abu Hamdia after being held in an Israeli jail. According to the Palestinian News and Info Agency, protests took place in Ramallah and Nablus City, and clashes with Israeli soldiers took place in Hebron, Abu Hamdia's hometown. Dozens have been injured, including from tear gas bombs. Abu Hamdia died after being diagnosed with advanced cancer. His family and advocates are calling for details from an autopsy and his medical record to be released, saying treatment was delayed. His body was transferred to the Palestinian Authority today, and a burial is scheduled for Thursday. Also today, Israel confirmed airstrikes in Gaza City after it reported mortar fire from the coastal strip. The tension comes as Palestinian prisoners refused food in a mass hunger strike inside prisons. For more, we're joined by Anat Litvin, the head of the Prisoners Department at Physicians for Human Rights in Israel. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you very much.
First, a spokesperson for Israel's Prisons Authority said that Abu Hamdia was treated by Israeli specialists and died in a hospital in Beersheba. The results of an autopsy have yet to be released. Can you describe the circumstances that led to his death? What kind of care he needed or received?
Well, I'll start from the beginning, and it begins with his family saying that he was complaining of sore throat or pain in his throat since about approximately August 2012. So this is quite a long time. And we know that he was examined in Soroka Hospital in the city of Beersheba only during February and March. And this is pretty late. We feared that there was a delay. Delay in treatment is a common thing in Israeli prisons.
Well, in this case, or in other cases, other prisoners you've worked with, how hard is it to get access to outside specialists?
Everything that needs to be done outside the prison is potentially delayed because they need the guards to accompany the person, a vehicle to take him, sometimes hospitalization. It costs money, and this cost causes delays. Also, if a person is transferred from one prison to another, it can cause a delay because then he will perform the tests in a different hospital. He will start waiting on the list again in a different hospital. All of this. But from many years of following the situation in the Israeli prisons, we in Physicians for Human Rights here think that separating the medical system from the prison services and putting it under the responsibility and authority of the Israeli Ministry of Health might be the solution for that.
So inside the prison, the doctors that treat the patients, they're not independent. What is their relationship to the prison service?
Well, the doctors are employed by the prison service. The prison service is under the responsibility of the Ministry for Public Security, not under any medical authority. Okay, and the doctors are guards. They wear uniforms, and they are seen many times by their patients as part of the authority that punishes them, that holds them in custody, rather than being seen as their doctor, whose first priority is supposed to be their health. So there is a mutual mistrust.
Your group, Physicians for Human Rights, has also reported that the use of painkillers is very common. Sometimes it comes in instead of a proper diagnosis or a more complex treatment. How widespread is this?
I don't have statistics in numbers, but this is a very common complaint, and it comes not only from Palestinian prisoners, but also from Israeli common law prisoners, and also from migrant workers and asylum seekers who are held in custody in Israel. They also say that, first of all, you are treated for everything with the painkillers, and then it can take a pretty long time until something else is decided upon as a treatment, or until they try to find out what you're actually suffering from.
And with the specific case of Abu Hamdia, who died this week, Anna Litvin, with Physicians for Human Rights, do you expect that his autopsy or that information will be made public soon, that it will be released in the coming days?
I guess it depends on how much longer Abu Hamdia's case is going to stay in the media and how much noise it's going to make. I hope it will be made public, but we will try to, with the permission of his family, of course, get the results of the autopsy. But not only the autopsy, because what needs to be examined is his medical records from the prison from the last year. It needs to be examined when he started to complain, because it should be recorded in his medical file in prison. When he started to complain, what was the complaint, how he was treated, why he wasn't brought to a hospital earlier, what sort of treatment they recommended in the hospital, why he was hospitalized he was hospitalized at the end of March, and then he died several days afterwards, why he wasn't hospitalized before. These are the questions that interest us.
Anat Litvin is director of the Prisoners Department at Physicians for Human Rights in Israel. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
This is FSNN reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression, and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at fsrn.org.
And now we go to northern Iraq, where the long-running standoff between Baghdad and the Kurdistan region over Iraq's disputed territories has left the area without a functioning government. As a result, many residents lack effective basic services such as power, water, and crucially, medical care. But as FSRN's Hermione G found out, one Kurdish NGO is trying to fill that gap by sending mobile medical teams to some of the villages in the area.
It's 9 a.m. on a sunny morning, and the female residents of the northern Iraqi village of Kandal are gathering in the small leafy courtyard of the local mosque. But they haven't come to pray, they're here to see the doctor, a rare opportunity in this part of the country. Kandal is located in the district of Mahmur, on the edge of a busy main road connecting Kirkuk and the Kurdistan regional capital of Erbil. The village is part of Iraq's so-called disputed territories, land claimed by both the central government in Baghdad and the Kurdish authorities. Although the issue was supposed to be resolved by a referendum several years ago, the vote still hasn't taken place, and for the time being, the area is in limbo.
This place is not country. We don't have government. There's no doctor one, there's no hospital.
That's Juan Abdullah, a teacher at the small village school. She's brought her students to see the mobile medical unit visiting the village today. The health team, which focuses on providing care to women and children, will visit one of six villages in the area every week for the next 3 months.
Girls, they are need to doctors. Sometimes they are sick and they can't go to doctors. Maybe in America, be 911. But here, we don't have number emergency. And if it was someone and get be seeking a lot, takes time to go to the Erbil and Mahmur. Maybe in going to dying.
And emergencies aren't the only problem, says Dr. Afifa Saeed, who's with the medical team today. The poor, high-sugar diet of the local women also takes a toll on their health.
Most of the problem here, they have chronic disease. High blood pressure, diabetic, general condition, not good. It is very important to have a hospital in the same place to follow them every day. I went to 5 villages before this village. No hospital. Should be every village who has health center, okay? Or every day portable center, every day. Not every week. What can I do for them? What can I do?
In fact, Dr. Saeed is doing a lot. By lunchtime, she's seen 55 women in her tiny but well-equipped make-do doctor's office.
Portable clinics, but it is perfect, okay? We have everything. We have disposable speculum. We use disposable speculum for examination, BP examination, vaginal examination of the woman. We follow the woman about the family planning. You know, here they have many kids. So we provide for him. We have condom, we have contraceptive tablet, we have intrauterine device here. We have medicine, all types of medicine. For women, for kids, everything is portable.
And it's vital that the women have access to qualified practitioners, Dr. Saeed says. In the absence of a local health center, Kandal's residents rely on local pharmacists for medical treatment.
They give medicine to the people. If they alone give medicine, not good. With doctor, okay, but without doctor, no. They give wrong medicine. But this is the real thing in the village.
Today, Dr. Saeed gives a prescription to one woman, 55-year-old Hadia, who's come to see her about a gynecological problem. Clutching a small plastic bag filled with tablets, Hadia says she hasn't had any treatment until now.
If the doctor doesn't come, we have to go to Mahmur or Erbil. It's a problem for me to go. We have to drive very far and spend money. We need a hospital here, not just for us, but for our children.
The Women's Empowerment Organization, START, runs the mobile medical unit in conjunction with the Kurdistan Ministry of Health and the French Embassy in Baghdad. START's director, Safin Ali, hopes the initiative will improve medical awareness in the villages, as well as prompt the Kurdistan Regional Government, or KRG, to come up with a long-term solution for the residents of the disputed areas.
In the end, we will do 1 week training for girls about first aid, so we leave something behind. And, you know, bringing the KRG staff members is to draw the attention of the KRG Ministry of Health that this area needs a hospital. Like a mobile medical team could serve the purpose for, you know, a short period of time, but for the long run, they need to build a hospital here. They need to have a clinic here.
At the moment, however, Ali says, given the ongoing tension over the disputed areas, both Baghdad and the KRG have other priorities. So the residents of Kandal are likely going to have to wait. Hermione G., FSRN, Kandal, Northern Iraq.
Northern Iraq is also receiving an influx of people fleeing parts of Syria as fighting continues in Damascus, Aleppo, and other parts of the country. According to the UN Refugee Agency, hundreds of new people are arriving in the Kurdistan region every day, where refugee camps are already overcrowded. As resources are stretched, conditions are degrading at the camps, which aid workers characterize as below humanitarian standards. Disease outbreaks, including diarrhea and hepatitis A, are affecting thousands. UN Radio's Diane Penn reports.
UNHCR says more than 90% of the Syrians who have fled to Iraq have found refuge in the country's Kurdistan region, mostly with local communities. An estimated 800 to 900 people arrive there each day, which is double the figures of just 3 months ago. Overcrowding at camps is of paramount importance, says UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards.
The situation at Domi's camp in the northwest of Iraq is especially worrying. Domi's is currently home to around 35,000 Syrian refugees and is critically overcrowded. Thousands of families are sharing tents with newly arrived refugees. Almost 3,500 families do not have their own shelters.
UNHCR reports that overcrowding is also putting a heavy burden on sanitation in the camp, as well as contributing to disease outbreaks and tension between residents. The agency is working with the Iraqi government and the local authorities in Kurdistan region to secure more space for refugees. Meanwhile, in Syria, the World Food Program is struggling to provide aid to more than 2 million people across the country. WFP spokesperson Elizabeth Beers reports that there have been more than 20 attacks on its trucks, drivers, and warehouses.
I think nobody has been hurt. They have been kidnapped and sometimes released after hours of negotiation with the armed groups and those who had kidnapped them. Sometimes we recover the food assistance, which is inside the truck, sometimes not, depends, but nobody has been hurt or killed so far.
Foreigners affected by the Syrian crisis, both inside and outside the country, are also receiving assistance to return home, says Jumbe Omari Jumbe of the International Organization for Migration.
Last week, we assisted 11 vulnerable migrants from Ethiopia to Vietnam and Bangladesh to go home. We also supported 229 Sudanese, Somalis, Eritreans to settle in Sweden, the United States, and elsewhere.
The Syrian crisis is now in its third year. More than 1 million Syrians are now registered as refugees or awaiting registration in the region. Diane Penn, United Nations.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Cobb. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Carla West. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FSRN. Thanks for listening in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.